Okay, I'm so excited to introduce my next guest. Sally Bingham is a writer. She's a teacher, feminist activist, and philanthropist. Her first novel was published in 1961, followed by collections of short stories and poetries, additional novels, numerous plays produced off-Broadway and regionally, and a memoir. She was born and raised in Kentucky, and Sally currently lives and has for a while in Santa Fe. And today we're going to talk about The Blue Box, Three Lives in Letters, which is a result of the discovery of a forgotten blue box containing letters, memoir, manuscripts, and so much more, all papers and such of her great-grandmother, grandmother, and mother. But before we do, I want to acknowledge, as we come to the closure of Women's History Month, which has been all this month of March, the contributions that Sally has distinctly made as the founder of the Women's Project in New York, the Kentucky Foundation for Women in Louisville, and the Sally Bingham Archive of Women's History and Culture at Duke University. Preserving women's history, including the history of feminist theory and activism, just to name a couple. So I'm really, really happy to finally meet you, Sally, for the first time, and think this is kind of, in my own mind, a perfect month to have you visit Women's Focus.
Thank you, Carol. I'm just delighted to be here.
Yeah, good. I'm glad you're delighted to be here. And thanks for driving down today. I really, really appreciate that. So the blue box, tell us the story about the blue box and how it was found. And or did you always know it was there but never looked into it?
No, I never knew it was there. My mother was a very private and complicated woman. Most of our mothers are, I think. And she never revealed to me or to anyone else in the family that she had this blue box on the top shelf of her clothes closet. So when my sister Eleanor was cleaning out the house after mother died, now, 5 or 6 years ago, she found this mysterious blue box. It's very distinctive. It's quite large. It's a sort of pale aquamarine blue. We tried to repeat the cover on the cover of this book, The Blue Box. We didn't get it quite right, but kind of close. And so we had no idea what was in it or why it was there. And I think the only reason these letters and papers were preserved was that a remote cousin had sent them to Mother with some notes about who these women were. And I guess she just felt she couldn't really just throw them in the trash. I don't think she ever looked at them. She was not particularly interested in her mother's family. These were Virginia ladies. They had no money. They had a lot of belief in their own importance, but the world didn't think they were important. So my mother, being very focused on her husband's family, my father's family, really left these women in the dust, which is one of the main reasons why I wanted to write this book.
So when you started looking through the papers and reading them, was this kind of a revelation for you?
It was a great revelation.
Talk about that.
I, of course, had known my mother and my grandmother, not my great-grandmother. What I hadn't realized was how deep-dyed they were in Southern conservatism. They all came from Richmond, Virginia. Two of them lived there their whole lives. And I had sort of wanted to ignore the fact that they were all three racists. I didn't really want to think much about that. But it was forced upon me, particularly when I found the list of my great-grandmother's slaves by name, 13 slaves by name, first name, no last name, of course.
So you had no idea about that?
No, I had no idea. I didn't even really know for sure that they were slaveholders, although since this was Virginia before the Civil War, it was very likely that they were slaveholders, but nobody had ever discussed that. And so that was quite a shattering revelation. My immediate family, my parents considered themselves great liberals and ran one of the liberal newspapers in the South for three generations. So to see that the background was this darkness of racism was really both fascinating and appalling. In fact, my great-grandmother Sally's section in the book, it's divided into three books for the three women, ends with her father being taken to see a hanging. And as we all know from history, for many, many years, lynchings were public occasions, people would take children to lynchings. This little boy, who was about 5, was pretty horrified by what he saw and woke up in the night with a nightmare, saying he didn't want to see anything like that again. But it's presented in the most matter-of-fact way, as though, well, you're just going on a picnic, except you're going to see somebody hung.
You know, just as an aside, I think through high school, maybe even when I was in college, I felt this way. I just felt like the Civil War was like ancient history. I don't really mean ancient history, but so long ago. So now in these past years, knowing of people, which is including yourself, who, you know, just a couple of generations ago, a few generations ago, actually had like a great-grandmother who was alive during Civil War time, just kind of blows me away.
It's amazing. She was a teenager during the Civil War and living in Richmond, which, of course, was the center of the great battles of the Civil War. But she managed to sugarcoat the account in her memoir as being a sort of rather odd period when she couldn't get any new clothes, which was a big issue. But really, everything else was not too bad. And her father had turned their house into a hospital for the Confederate wounded. And she made that sound like, oh, it was just lots of fun to have these young men lying around in the house, without any reference to the fact of the enormous number of deaths and the enormous number of amputations and death through amputation. So she had the ability, and I have to admit, Carol, I sort of admire it, to make everything look better than it really was. And I think particularly for a young girl going through that war, none of us here have had the experience of a war on our home territory. Maybe that was the only way she could survive.
Mm-hmm. So you had, I can hardly imagine just discovering about one's ancestors and seeing that they were slave owners.
Yeah, it was quite astonishing. And probably one of the reasons Mother did not want to know very much about her mother's family was that she would have had difficulty as a liberal reconciling her own point of view with the point of view of these women in her family. Her liberalism didn't run that deep. It usually doesn't. When you're up against it, something much worse comes out. And when she was up against the civil rights agitations, which started in Kentucky because the first school system to be desegregated in Brown versus Board of Education were the Louisville schools, and there was an enormous amount of protest against it in 1954, and she was very ambivalent about that. She did not really want to think of her children going to school with African-American children. So again, the issue is, when do your ideals come up against the reality that may be very uncomfortable and very disconcerting? And for her, she really couldn't make the transition.
Well, in some ways, that's a similar thing with you, where your ideals and sort of the revelations come up against each other. I mean, the ancestors, those relatives are not alive anymore, but I don't know if you felt at all like the rug was pulled out from under you?
Not really, because this sounds a little unbelievable, but I'd had a suspicion along.
Yeah, okay.
Because looking at old photographs of these women, and there were a few of those around, and just looking at the way they dressed and the way they carried themselves, it was pretty clear that they were members of what they believed was the Southern aristocracy. They had no money, but in the South, that doesn't necessarily matter if you can claim that your ancestors came over on one of those small boats that carried so many thousands of people, as we know, to settle the east coast of this country.
Now, at the beginning of the book, you talk about, mixed up with the sides of the family. Your grandmother, or great-grandmother, Sally.
Yes.
Whose family was that? Owned 2 plantations outside of Richmond.
Yes. And they were slave run.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, at one point when Sally's mother had gone out to one of the plantations, and it was just when the Civil War was there was a battle breaking out, and she decided she better get back to Richmond. I don't know how far it was away, probably 20 miles. So she had the slave coachman drive her in the carriage with her baby son back to Richmond, and when they got to the James River, the last bridge across it was in flames because the Confederates retreating had lit all the bridges on fire to prevent the Union soldiers from coming in. And so the coachman said to her, "What should I do?" And she said, "Drive on." And he drove through the flames.
Wow.
So one of the other myths that they tended to believe in was that their slaves were their most loyal supporters, would never leave them, had no interest in emancipation, just wanted to stay there on the plantation. And that's a very familiar Southern myth even today.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it sure is. So you had quite a bit of revelation going on when you discovered those papers, and what happened then? What did you do? Go through all of it in one sitting, did you?
No, I was sifted through it pretty slowly because there was a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And had to arrange it in some kind of chronological order, and also had to decide what to do with the various notes that this cousin who had collected all these papers had put on them. And a lot of the notes were very dismissive. There was one very disturbed young man who had been wounded in the Civil War and really never recovered, and there was a big collection of his letters to his mother, pleading to her after the war to help him. He had no money. They'd really sent him away from home. And the note from the cousin was a lot of foolish complaining from this mama's boy. Well, he had reason to complain. He was starving to death in Memphis. He did eventually die in Memphis because no one in the family would help him after he declared that he didn't believe in God. After going through the Civil War, you can see why you might not believe in God. So I had to discard some of these comments because they were not my impression at all of these letters. And I also had to read them. And some of these letters, well, of course, they're all in handwriting. Handwriting was usually beautiful. But the ones written during the Civil War were cross-written because there was so little paper that if you were going to write a letter, you'd write it vertically first, and then you'd write the second page horizontally. And these are a puzzle to read.
Well, when you first went through these papers, what were your intentions for them?
I wasn't really sure.
Because you said you had to read them. Now, it was like, okay, you're going to have to sit down and read these letters, or I had to, because how can I not read them?
How can I not?
Right.
And I also, since I was interested in putting them in the Sally Bingham archive at Duke, I wanted to go through and see if these would be appropriate. They're, in a way, oddly inappropriate because these women were such racists and, needless to say, didn't have a very high opinion of women either.
But it still is part of history.
Yeah, it is part of history, and we can't forget that.
That's right.
You know, we have to remember that. Yeah. And in my mother's case, when I got to her, that was full of revelations too, because I didn't realize that when she was growing up as one of six girls in Richmond with no money, and her mother had big aspirations for these girls to marry well, my mother, who was probably a good deal brighter than other people in the family, decided that she had to go to college. And nobody in the family had gone to college. Neither women nor men. It was just not part of what they did. The girls went to some kind of finishing school, and that was about it. So in order to go to college, she had to figure out how to get herself a scholarship. And in order to do that, she left home at 16 and went to live with an older woman. Now, this would make anybody today wonder what was going on. Of course, nobody wondered, apparently. Or if they wondered, they didn't say anything. But anyway, she lived with Louise Burley, very interesting woman, of playwright and theater producer, for 2 years. And Louise helped her to get herself together and get a scholarship to Radcliffe College, the girls' part of Harvard. And it was a special scholarship. It was for people who live, for girls who live further than 35 miles from Boston. Shows you how circumscribed those East Coast colleges were and still are to some degree. So she went and was a very serious Greek and Latin scholar, worked really hard, wrote a lot of papers, which I read very carefully. And then she met my father, and everything kind of went to pieces. She realized this was going to be the great catch. He was young, good-looking. He had a lot of money. This would be her entrance to a different kind of life. And so she more or less let her scholarship slide, even though she'd gotten a very prestigious fellowship to the American University in Athens. So it was also an example of how we do sometimes let go of our dreams when some easier and more attractive option presents itself. She saw what she was looking for and pursued my father for 4 years. He was having way too good a time to want to get married and finally pinned him down, but it was 4 years. So the letters of those 4 years were included in the blue box too. And quite heartbreaking in a way, because whenever you see a woman really laying herself out to try to gain the attention of this butterfly man, it's quite touching because you realize she's just overextending herself terribly. She did get him in the end, and maybe it was worth it. I don't know. It's impossible to judge. But it was sad for me to see that because she had such ability and she couldn't quite hang on to it.
If you just joined us, this is Women's Focus. My name is Carol Boss, and I'm talking with Sally Bingham, and we're talking about her book from 2014, The Blue Box, Three Lives in Letters, and those are the letters that were discovered in the blue box by Sally's sister, and it's the letters of her great-grandmother, grandmother, and then, of course, mother. So what was... Did you see a theme emerging?
Yes.
From these different generations between these three women?
The theme is really secrecy. Great commitment to not noticing, or if you notice, don't say anything about it. I think it had its root in racism, where you don't notice that a slave is being lynched, you don't notice that a slave is being beaten, and you don't mention it. So it all goes underground. And the theme of secrecy continues. In fact, my next book, I think, I'm just beginning to work on it, is going to be on the theme of family secrets, because there's an old AA expression, you're only as sick as your secrets. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. Also, a good deal of silence about various gender choices. A lot of the women in my family were lesbians. They were not necessarily out of the closet. A lot of the men were actually bisexual, managed to pull that off. And yet it was the kind of thing that was never mentioned, could not be mentioned.
Is this your generation?
Yeah. Well, my generation, no, my mother and father's generation.
Uh-huh.
My generation, the two... this is going out on a limb a little bit, but the two of my brothers who died very, very young and tragically, one of them was very uncertain about his gender identity. And at Harvard in the 1960s, early 60s, that was just intolerable. Nobody could deal with that. Pretty soon things started to open up, but the early 60s were still the old days. And I think it's the reason he died at 21. I may never really know for real, but certainly he was in anguish because he was so emotionally involved with his roommate and he didn't think he should be, and he eventually dropped out and went back to Kentucky and died 6 months later. We never know about these situations, but there's always that suspicion for me when there's a very young death in that period that life has become intolerable because the secret can no longer be kept. The secret is somehow creeping out, and there are going to be all kinds of repercussions. My aunt, this is a marvelous story. You'll enjoy this, Carol. My father's older sister, Henrietta Bingham, didn't believe in secrets. And she came out as a teenager at Smith College, and this would have been in about 1917, fell in love with her one of her professors. They ran off to London, and of course everybody was absolutely appalled. How could this happen? But the only person who was not particularly appalled, it seems, was her father. He was the American ambassador to the court of St. James at the time. So these two women came to live with him in the embassy.
That is wild. wild story. 1917?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And he had only one rule with them. They could do anything, go anywhere, which they did, drink, have parties, but they could not wear slacks. That was the rule. Anything else you can do.
That would be scandalous to him.
But you cannot wear slacks. So there were people who did sort of dare to be themselves, but often there was a huge penalty to pay, as we know.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is kind of a mind-blowing story. And I know there were things like that that happened, but that's quite something. So you saw the weaving together, the secrecy, and did you immediately, I mean, these were all your blood.
Yes.
What was the connection that you felt? I know there was that legacy of writers,
yes,
of writing.
Yes, definitely.
For sure.
Yes. Their love of words was really the great gift that I received. These were all people who read all the time, memorized poetry, quoted poetry. They were devout Episcopalians. They knew the prayer book by heart. They could recite all kinds of examples from Christian theology. It's only recently that I've begun to realize what a straitjacket that kind of language is. It's very formal. Very precise. It's all Latin verbs, roots. It's based in really English attitudes about language. And it's terribly hard on some people. They don't understand it. They don't speak it. It's almost now like a foreign language. And it's a form of oppression because you can use words that people listening to you maybe don't entirely understand. They don't know what that means. They're embarrassed to ask what that means. I heard someone the other day use the word vociferous, and the person he was talking to said, "I don't know what that word means." That used to be a fairly common word. It's not very common anymore. And in a way, it's a two-edged sword, Carol, because we lose a lot of the specificity of the language as we lose vocabulary. But it's also a way to keep people out.
I would love for you to read something from the book. Do you want to explain the format of the book?
Yes, I will. The format is, there's, first of all, I say it's for my four mothers and name these three women: Sally Montague Lefroy, that's my great-grandmother for whom I'm named, Helena Lefroy Caperton, my grandmother, and Mary Caperton Bingham, my mother. And then I start with a quote from a novel that has always been very important to me, Middlemarch by George Eliot. As we all know, George Eliot was a woman who had to use a man's name. And the quote is, "The growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts, and that things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been is half owing to the number who lived faithfully a hidden life and rest in unvisited tombs." That's very important, particularly today, because we tend to think only those who deem themselves important are important. Then there's a short introduction, and then I go immediately into my great-grandmother's section, followed by my grandmother's section and my mother's, and then a final word about my life in college in the 1950s and how the attitudes of these women continue to have a pretty drastic effect on me. So I'll read a little bit from the introduction. All three were tiny women. Sally, Helena, and Mary, my great-grandmother, my grandmother, and my mother, barely topped 5 feet. In girlhood, they were as proud of their small waists as of their intelligence, which was considerable. Writing was their blessing, and each used it to create a reality more appropriate to her personality, more manageable, and more forgiving of her time. Autumn Garner, Sally called her gilded memoir, written for her granddaughters in the 1940s, toward the end of her long life. Legends of Virginia, Helena named her second collection of short stories, published in 1950 with its light dressing of sarcasm. Mary forged a romantic legend from the many courtship letters that documented her 4-year pursuit of the man who would later become my father. All three women were tiny, but they had held their heads high, though their pride was based in part on an unexamined faith, never directly spoken, in their racial superiority. The accoutrements of gentility defined them, as well as an adherence to a written and spoken language shaped by 19th century English fiction and poetry, classical Greek and Latin texts, and the King James Bible. Through the devastation of the Civil War, financial disaster, and the early loss of her husband, Sally turned to pen and paper to record a version of her life that must have been to her at times more palatable than the reality itself. For Helena, the language of Edwardian romance, already outdated, sugared the tales of her struggles in raising six daughters and provided a bulwark against the chaos that her large family and lack of money brought to her door. Mary's education, she was the first in her family to graduate from college, gave her a larger vocabulary based on those classical texts and her family's ever dependable King James Bible, slightly influenced but never overwhelmed by the radical changes of the 1920s. Long before I knew the details of my foremothers' lives, I recognized the theme that ran like a steel thread through their disparate personalities, indomitability, even when the times called for suppleness. To what extent did this steel thread tie up their secrets? How closely linked were their unquestioned feeling of superiority, social, racial, moral, intellectual, to their ability to survive, even flourish, as their fortunes rose and sank? For years, I could only speculate. And then I'd go on to describe finding the blue box, which was the end of some of my speculations, not all of them.
Not all of it. Did it still leave lots of questions unanswered for you?
Lots of questions unanswered, particularly the role of the men in the family, because they didn't write as many letters. I don't think men ever did write as many letters. So there isn't as much of a record. And because these women were so dominant, these men remain rather shadowy figures in the background. They were primarily useful if they made a lot of money. If they didn't make a lot of money, it was, well, forget about them, because these women were socially enormously ambitious. And since those were the days when women on their own could hardly hope to make any money, you had to find a man who could do it for you.
When I was reading some of this, I found myself getting, it's on a certain level, a little bit envious, because I was thinking last night, I could never imagine coming upon a box with the letters of my mother and my grandmother, my great-grandmother, because they never produced such materials.
Yeah.
Their lives were so different.
Yes.
And there's something about, I mean, it could be opening up a can of worms, of course.
Of course, that too. And also, as you know, Carol, there's huge class issues here. Women didn't have the time to write letters, you know, the way women have had to work. They didn't perhaps have access to the materials they needed. They maybe didn't have the kind of education that made them comfortable writing. So it's one reason the archive that I established at Duke is really struggling to find the papers of women who were not of the top class, who were not well educated, who maybe only wrote a few letters in their entire lifetime, and particularly to get into the parts of our culture that we don't really recognize, which are African American, Asian, Hispanic, and so on. It's hard to do because the written material often just doesn't seem to be there. And one of my endeavors, I haven't succeeded with this yet, is that I think we ought to collect lists. Because many women who never write letters do write lists.
Yes, 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 yes. No, I think that's a brilliant idea. One of the things I wanted to talk about with you was the importance of archiving and, you know, women's personal stories. But you're absolutely right. I didn't take my thinking that far, in that there are so many women who didn't write the paperwork that is being collected and put into archives.
Yeah. And of course, as we know, the letter writing age has come to an end.
Mm-hmm.
So the archive may find that in the next few years, they become a repository for the past, but not for the future. I don't think anybody has really dealt with this notion of printing out emails, and emails are not really letters anyway.
Right.
So we may lose, and in large part lose women's history, because the people who write letters or used to write letters were usually women. So it would be their version, whereas the men, if they were important, maybe made speeches or published books or wrote editorials, but the women were told the more personal side of the story. More personal, but just as important. As we all know, the personal is political. And when we lose that, we lose more than half of our history. It's very, very ominous, very alarming, because it means the patriarchal voice is the only voice. The other voice is gone. And that's been a struggle all along to try to keep our voices from being submerged.
You know, people archive things online. It's not the same thing.
No, it's not the same thing, yeah. And this is part of the eternally ongoing struggle. As we know, there's still very few women in Congress. I think it's the lowest of any of the Western countries, something like 17. There are very few women playwrights. That's improved a little bit. Women are not being published at the rate at which they're writing. Women are not writing reviews of any kind. It's just an ongoing struggle. And the reason for the struggle is very complicated, but I do think one reason is we have a lot to say. And a lot of people don't really want to hear what we have to say. It's not as though we have almost nothing to say, and therefore does it matter that we're silenced. We have a lot to say, and we also often have a very refreshingly subversive point of view. You hear it in women's humor all the time. This is just straight subversion. And in this society, and probably in all societies, that's extremely dangerous.
Sally Bingham is who you're listening to, and this is Women's Focus, and my name is Carol Boss. We're here the second, third, fourth Saturdays of every month from noon to two. First Saturday is always Voces Feministas. And we're talking about her book, The Blue Box, Three Lives in Letters. So how long did you work on putting this together?
This was about 2 years.
2 years in the making.
I'm very fortunate in having a wonderful publisher, a small literary publisher called Saraband Books.
And they're out of Louisville.
They're in Louisville. And anyone who writes short fiction, poetry, or essays should really look at their website. They have two competitions every year, one for a collection of essays, one for a collection of poetry. They do make beautiful books. The editing is just amazing, particularly now when we don't really have very many good editors. And so I was so fortunate to be able to have their help in the final process of putting the book together. It ends with, as I said, my experience in college in the 1950s, which was something I didn't know about. And this aspect of it I didn't know about till I found these letters in the blue box between my mother and the dean at Radcliffe College, where I had gone, as my mother did, in which they were bewailing the fact that I, as an undergraduate, had written a story that had gotten a lot of attention and won prizes and procured me an editorship at Mademoiselle magazine. This was the way up in those days for women writers.
What story was that?
It's called Winter Term. And it was an innocuous story from anybody's point of view, and in fact a very sad story about this, told from the point of view of this Harvard boy who has this Radcliffe girl hanging on him. They've gotten sexually involved, and he's trying to break away, and he doesn't know how to do it, and she's getting desperate, and so on. And the fact that they ended up in the back seat of a car in a parking lot caused such alarm, as though it wasn't happening all the time, because this was the era of parietal rules, so you couldn't go in the dormitories, that my mother and the dean just wrote a lot back and forth about could something be done. It was going to be published nationally. Was there some way to make it clear that this was not Radcliffe. Of course, it wasn't anyway. And it gave me a very peculiar feeling because I had known that there had been all this controversy on the part of my mother and the dean. I did know that the dean had called me in during this time. I'd never met the dean before. I didn't even know what a dean was, really. And she was sitting at her desk, very formally dressed in her suit and high heels and everything. And she had a little dog under the desk who was yipping, and she was very serious. And she said to me she didn't think I understood that this story of mine was causing a great deal of trouble for the college and that, in fact, their alumni giving would be affected. What did I know?
Little did you know that this innocuous story.
I was 19 years old.
Yeah.
For all I knew, it would be the end of the college.
But that's incredible. You were offered an editorship at Mademoiselle. Wow, that is.
Yes, I was part of a really interesting group of young women who took that. It was really a dreadful job. I mean, you were supposed to go in to Alina Rubinstein and have your face made up and put these clothes on that were supposed to be what college girls were going to wear in the fall. It was pretty dreadful. But on the other hand, it was New York. And, you know, you got to see what that was like mm-hmm. and work on the magazine. I'm grateful for it. It gave me a good start.
Yeah, I would think it was pretty prestigious.
Yeah, it was. Well, Sylvia Plath is the one who had had it 2 or 3 years earlier.
And, oh, really?
And wrote that memoir called The Bell Jar.
Yes, uh-huh.
Which is about that experience.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I read that so many years ago. Wow.
So
I recall something that I read that is actually a word we were using on the last segment on this show earlier, which was that you said the one of the traits that linked you to your great grandmother, grandmother, and mother was that unyielding resiliency. Resilience, I
Of course,
say.
As soon as I wrote that, Carol, I began to question it.
Oh, I was going to ask you to expound on it somewhere.
Well, I was always the one that stuck out as being different. I was one of five siblings. The one that didn't quite conform, didn't make my debut, much to the horror of my parents.
You mean you weren't a debutante?
No. And the reason I wasn't was just in line with what they had taught me from childhood, which is everybody is equal and everyone must be treated the same. And the one Jewish girl in my class at this small girls' school was not going to be able to make her debut because the country club wouldn't permit her to be there. And I found out about that, and I was horrified, and I told my parents there was no way I was going to do this. Well, they were even more horrified. Because, again, acting on an ideal is something completely different from believing in it. So I always was the one who didn't quite fit. And then I left home just as soon as I could at 17 and lived in Boston and New York and really never thought to have anything more to do with Kentucky until the late 80s when a series of family events brought me back there, and I ended up in an enormous fight with the people in my family about the ownership of their companies. And if I ever showed any resilience, that was then, because that was a very tough period, very tough. But it had the happy outcome of shooting me out of Kentucky finally and bringing me out to New Mexico.
How long ago was that you got shot 91, out of Kentucky?
91. Yeah. I had no idea what I was getting into, but I knew I had to get out, and it seemed like this was pretty far out at the time.
Does it still seem pretty far out?
No, it's way too civilized.
What would you call the format of your book? I read someone referred to it as a novella.
No, it's not a novella because it's based on fact.
Yeah.
No, it's a form of memoir.
Yeah.
It's a form of memoir. An odd form because, of course, I didn't know my great-grandmother personally. You know, I did know my grandmother and obviously my mother. But it's a memoir based on letters. Could never be called a novella because that's a work of the imagination.
Well, I don't know where I read that unless I saw it referring to another book of yours. And
no, it might be this. People are very confused by these books that don't quite fit.
I thought I saw it referred to as short stories, too, and I said,
And, of course, it's
not short stories.
No,
right.
No.
Yeah.
No, it's full of quotations from these papers and letters as well as my digressions upon them.
What kind of response have you gotten from, particularly from women around the country?
It's very muted, but I find the response from women now is muted.
What do you mean by that?
There's a kind of quietness about the way we respond. I don't get the kind of enthusiasm that I got, say, with the resurgence of the women's movement in the 70s, when there was a lot more public support for women's work, women's writing, women's activities. Now it's more as though it has to be blended into the great literary tradition, which, as we know, is primarily male. And then people talk about the quality of the writing, which is very good, and I'm delighted to hear that. They try to assign me a place, which is pretty hard to do. So I almost feel as though I have to be melded into a tradition that I don't really belong to.
So do you think it has anything to do with your roots?
Yes. There always will be that question.
Mm-hmm.
Even all these years later, the question of whether being a Southerner disables me, and to some degree, there certainly is a threat of that. Inherited attitudes, inherited racism, narrowness of perspective, that's a problem. The other problem is that since I'm known as the one who caused terrible problems to this family, there's also that question of whether I'm some kind of criminal. It would be hard to define what kind of criminal, but anyway, as we know, most women who are at all active are suspected of being some kind of criminal.
Well, you come from a family that owned a big newspaper, and I'm not familiar with the struggles that went on. I think I've seen reference to it. Was that quite a national story?
Believe it or not, it was. And it's a long time ago now. But the reason it was a national story is that I think the newspapers, and then it was primarily newspapers, were so protective of their own that whenever one of the few big family-owned newspapers was under attack, everybody else, all the other newspaper owners, would congregate to protect this threatened member of their fraternity. I don't think it would have happened if it had been a radio station, for instance, or even a TV station. There was such a feeling of brotherhood in those days. You know, all those newspaper publishers knew each other.
And we're talking about the Louisville Courier.
Louisville Courier Journal and the Louisville Times, the afternoon paper, mm-hmm. as well as their big printing monopoly and their CBS affiliate and their WHAS radio. It was in Kentucky a monopoly of information. It's a small state, and there wasn't much reason for there to be any competing entity coming up. But it was a monopoly, which, of course, gave it in the state enormous political power in terms of who was going to get to be governor and so on.
So does it mean that family members are still?
No, it was sold to Gannett.
Oh, okay.
So it's right. another one That's of the right. big chain newspapers now. And there's a sadness in that. It's not as interesting a newspaper. There's much less local coverage. They don't even have a book page anymore. I edited the book page for about 7 years. So, you know, there's a great loss when these newspapers go entirely corporate. They're already pretty corporate, but go entirely corporate. And I will always look back on that battle with very mixed feelings because it caused me to be the family really to disown me, which tends to happen to us, as we know. But that was very, very painful. And fortunately, in all the years since, some of that has been resolved.
So, Sally, I'm sorry to say, I really am, that we only have about 5 minutes left.
I figured we're running out.
So it sounded like we were going to have a lot of time together. Maybe we can continue the conversation one day.
Well, I'd love to. And in fact, Carol, I'll just take a minute or two to tell you about my next book because it couldn't be more different. It's a biography, and it's a biography of a woman you may have heard of named Doris Duke.
A wild woman, I think.
Oh, yes.
Wildly divergent interests.
Yes, and behavior that people didn't understand and an enormous amount of money, which is now $1.3 billion behind the foundation she established through her will, the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation. And anyone in the arts ought to know about that foundation because it's one of the few that supports particularly modern dance. And with that kind of money, everybody in New Mexico ought to be looking at their website and seeing how they could apply, because that's a huge foundation.
You know, I don't know much about her, but I have a feeling that it's going to be a really juicy story.
It's going to be very juicy. And I have to realize that that's the reason people will want to buy the book. I had other reasons for wanting to write it. I enjoy the juicy parts, too. But I also was very interested in her development as a philanthropist.
When will that be coming out?
Well, I haven't turned in my final draft yet. It's the publisher is Farrar Straus, and my deadline is June 15th. So I think it'll probably be next year, but I don't know for sure.
I am so happy that you came down here today from
Santa
Fe.
Thank you, Carol.
And I love having you on, and would love to talk more.